Welcome to the Mind Chimp Podcast. Hey, Asi, welcome to the Mind Chimp Podcast. How are we doing?
I'm fine. And yourself, Danny?
I'm not too bad. Sun is shining, so I guess nobody can really complain. Yeah,
it's all absolutely good. It's a beautiful day.
It is indeed. So, Asi, let's jump straight in. So, usually what I do is ask our kind of, you know, the people who are the guests on the podcast kind of to summarize their logline about who they are and what they do. Have you got one?
I think the closest thing that I can find is what I call legitimization of inquiry, which is very big words for something like making it okay to ask questions and to sometimes say, I don't know, which I try to say quite a lot.
I love it. Okay. So when you were in school, I say, and then the teacher would ask you kind of what is it you want to be when you grow up? What was the answer you would say to him?
Oh, wow. This ties beautifully into what I just said. I don't know was usually the answer. When I grew up, so my final years in high school, it would probably be a photographer. I'm going to keep my age to myself, but considering the fact that we had no smartphones back then and personal computers had four colors, and that was impressive in its own right, photography, I spent hours in the lab. And for me, the touchy-feely, I'm using my hands now, which you cannot see, you know, processing the film, printing the pictures, playing with it, always held an attraction. And when I started with computers, again, think late 80s, early 90s of the previous century, that tendency to play around remained. I'm very comfortable jumping into an HTML page or JavaScript, you know, modifying the score manifest and so on. It gives me the feeling that, I connect. It's not just this amazing magic which happens somewhere else, but I understand what's going on and it's important to me.
Okay, perfect. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the questions, I tend to ask my guests to pick four numbers from 1 to 100. So yeah, could you give me four random numbers, please?
Four random numbers. 12.
Okay.
37. Okay. 95. Yeah. And 26.
26, perfect. We'll come to them later
on. Did I win anything?
No, unfortunately not. But maybe you will later on down the line. Let's see. Okay. I know, obviously, we work together at Telefonica. So obviously, I know who you are and vice versa. But I guess maybe give us a bit of a brief over of maybe kind of who Asi is, his career, where he's come from and where he is now.
Okay, so professionally and generally who Asi is, I was born in Israel many years ago, as I mentioned before, and moved to the UK in 2003. But throughout my working life, apart from a two-year period where I took a break, it was always in the vast universe of corporate learning, and more specifically in digital learning. I started, being Israeli, I had to do my 3 years of national service, and I was recruited into a unit which specialized in using what was then known as CBT, computer-based training. We started with the Apple IIe, which had 16 colors, and I think it took off for me. It took off from there, and I always stayed in this field. So, using technology to enable people, to empower people, I think is something I'm a great believer in. It also manifests itself in the charities that I take part in. So, the e-learning charity Learn Appeal, which I'm a trustee of, and a few other activities. It always has been about using technology to empower people, especially people who need empowering, So people who are in communities which are more challenged, people who are in areas, geographical areas, which have a greater lack of empowerment. And I've been very fortunate to be able to touch quite a lot of things. So for those of you who don't know, Israel was a very high-tech place. So during the days of the first internet bubble, it was amazing to see the amount of money and the amount of research and the amount of thinking that was poured into it in the US and in Israel. I got to travel a lot, had the opportunity to take part in some amazing projects, both in civilian space and with the US and the Israeli defense forces. And learned a lot from pre-internet days, where I remember figures in the education ministry back then telling me that this internet is a great idea, but if you want to have proper video, we'll never work on the internet. You'll always need something different. I remember moving from satellite connections to the internet. Been around, seen most of it. I think that the constant is people and the way that people interact with technology. And I think one of the things that I'm most happy with is that for many years, I've seen us educators, and I count myself as an educator, forcing people to adapt to what we have, whether it's classrooms, whether it's computers, and so on. And we're finally reaching in the last, I don't know, 5, maybe 10 years, we're reaching a place where finally we're no longer forcing them, but we're actually swimming with them in the current, which is reality. We're finally blending in.
Okay. That's a great summary, I say, I guess. There's quite a bit there which we touched upon, and I wouldn't mind jumping into that a little bit more. So maybe, yeah, let's talk about Learn Appeal. So where did that come from? Where you know, What kind of got you involved into Learn Appeal?
This is years ago. So years ago, Jonathan Satchell from EPIC, today the Learning Technologies Group, had a vision and decided that the small incestuous industry, which is the digital learning industry, should do a more formalized, let me call it, a more formalized good. So, you know, we all give to charities and we all have different things and causes that we are dedicated to. But I think Jonathan was in an event for another industry and he was very impressed by this idea of an industry charity that everybody comes across. And let's face it, all of us jump around between organizations. So I've spent most of my life on the vendor side and skipped to the corporate doer side, as I call it, about 6 years ago. But you know, when you look at LinkedIn profile, say, oh, here's Mikey now, he's with company A, tomorrow he's with company B, and we know each other, you know, the names are the same names. And it makes sense, and I completely like the idea of having a cause that that the industry would comfortably rally around. So we started looking for causes. It was obvious for us that it wouldn't have to do something to, you know, in the context of learning and personal development. And as we looked through things, I think we reached a point where we realized that the place where we can have the most impact is where we probably are not. And the place we are not is the place where there is no internet and no connection. So Learn Appeal started working with a company by the name of Apetier to develop a solution to digital learning without internet. And what we came up with together, and when I say we, I mean the charity and Apetier, was a box, the Learn Appeal box, which can operate independently of an internet connection, even independently of an electrical connection. And it creates a local area network, a Wi-Fi network, which gives you up to 1 kilometer of coverage. And for 10 hours, if there's no electricity, that gives you access to anything that's on the box. So imagine a box that has Wikipedia, videos about whatever it is that you're doing, and so on. And that box can be dropped into anywhere. And part of the reason we were looking at it is that you have a lot of projects in Africa where our phones, our old phones, are donated or even resold, but there's no internet connection. So they're only used for half of their capability. By utilizing the Learn Appeal box, the idea is that these people immediately get access to knowledge. They don't have the full internet, but when we work with specific projects, they would say, okay, we have a project in area A. It is about teaching people how to, I don't know what, beekeeping, for example. So we would create content or curate content around beekeeping. That could be from how to set up the hive all the way to diagnosing problems and so on. And people will then have access to it from their phone.
Right. Okay. Wow. Wow. I did not know about that. So that's ace.
In fact, part of the way that we work with the industry is if people do not want to donate money, they can donate their time. So people like you, who have a background in digital learning, can donate their time and say, I will build a module on a specific subject. And they do that, and that's their donation, and it goes on the capsule and is used in the field.
Wow, that's really good, actually. I'm glad we picked up on that. So, you know, you mentioned you worked with defense and stuff like that. I guess let's jump into that a touch, as much as you can talk about. So what was one of the most interesting projects you worked on while working on defense clients and stuff?
I think for me personally, the most interesting project was the Mole project. And that was working with a branch of the US Defense Forces, looking at how to use mobile devices for disaster responses. If you think about the tsunami in Japan, for example, so there's been an earthquake out at sea, there's been a tsunami, there is a disaster situation, and there is a disaster relief or any earthquake that many countries come together to support. One of the problems you have is language. The other problem you have is communication. In many of these cases, you're sending people, you're waking somebody up at 3 o'clock in the morning. They need to grab their kit, get to the plane, and get to location X. The problem is that when they, first of all, you know, you're literally dropping them out of the into darkness. They have no idea what's going on. They have very little information. All they hear is what they are told on the way. One of the things we were looking at is whether we can devise an application which sits on your mobile. What you get is that call, and as you arrange your kit, the relevant information about the situation, what happened, what are the problems, why are you going there, magically appears on your phone, of course not magically, through the network, and by the time you are on the bus, plane, boat, whatever it is, you have all of the material on your phone, so the briefing is on your phone, you can go through it, if you have more questions, you can raise them, etc. And it also helps you communicate with other people once you're in the field. So companies like, I think back then it was Cisco and others, have a tendency to donate temporary infrastructure for these places. So if you think about an earthquake that knocks out all of the infrastructure, then certain companies will drop in boxes that will create an ad hoc infrastructure. And on that infrastructure, you can then use your phone, and that was part of the research, to identify resources that you need. For example, there's a large number of casualties. If it's an earthquake, it'll be people who were buried. So we need specific types of support equipment, and you can ask for that using your phone. You can also identify the reverse. So I've just had a shipment of, I don't know, the bandages dropped here in one of the schools that still survived. But we don't need as many as we have, so I post it on the system so that other people can look into it. We also start sharing images of the conditions, the situations that are either unique to the environment or require some more support. So again, if you think about the people who come to support, they will be a variety of people. You might be a driver, or you're not necessarily a medical respondent. So we would have the information about a medical condition that can develop as a result of the earthquake, with images and with explanations what to do. And then even if you don't have the right training and the background, you can at least look at it and say, oh, okay, I have somebody who's suffering from this. How can I get help? Or can I do steps 1, 2, and 3 before he goes into long-term treatment?
Wow. Wow. Okay. So you go from kind of, you know, defense, and then I think it was around about, did you join Telefonica around about 2013-ish, I think?
Yep.
That's kind of where our paths crossed. We, you know, we met at Telefonica and stuff. And I guess now you're at Kingfisher now. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. So I used to be on the vendor side for most of my life. So company who sell technology or concepts or content. But it was always, for me personally, it was always only half the story. Because if you're working for a vendor, when you reach the point of, you know, they sign on the dotted line, you've sold, essentially the project is now moving into the after-sale support. And those guys, after setup, will only work with the client when there are problems or a change. And I was very interested in seeing, A, how do solutions from different companies work together? And B, you know, what happens on a day-to-day, not when there's problems, you know, how does this stuff work? Once we've sold it, what do you actually do with it? So I've also always wanted to cross the line, so to speak, to the doer side. And I got the opportunity with Telefonica. It was Abby Bracken at the time, who I'm eternally grateful to, for bringing me in. And those 3 years, I think I've learned more than I did for the 15 before that.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, Telefonica was a great company to work for. I think they was they was kind of open up to ideas and doing things slightly differently. And, you know, I think one of the things which I can remember from Telefonica was it the Discovery app?
Yeah, the Discover app. Yeah.
So maybe talk about that a little bit, I say, because that was kind of how I think from what my memory reminds me of, I guess that was one of the biggest things which I really loved, and I thought it was a great tool. So yeah, maybe walk us through what that was.
So I think Discover is an interesting project, and definitely a demonstration of how we do not want to continue forcing people to use what we have, but rather we flex and you say, okay, if this is what you need, then this is what we're going to do for you. So we had the I'm going to say millennial. So we had a large group of young employees joining Telefonica, some of them straight out of uni, some of them in apprenticeship, some of them still in uni. And we found out, or rather they complained, to be frank, that they, you know, they can get everything they need in terms of understanding, learning, development about what Telefonica does and who it is, but there are some fundamentals that they are completely missing. And if you think about it, and I think that's one of the things that hit me, is I use tools like Outlook daily, yet I cannot tell you when somebody actually taught me or walked me through how to schedule a meeting or how to reserve a room. And when you throw somebody into an environment as fast as Telefonica or as fast as most corporates today, the challenges around, you know, landing in a running motion. And if we expect them to do that, then these fundamentals of how to schedule a room cannot be left open. So we started working with them to try and understand what would work best, because, you know, the traditional thinking, especially back then, would be, okay, so let's do a recording, stick it on the LMS and see what, you know, and see if it's helpful, because that's obviously what they need. But for us, it was a little bit more than that, because these young joiners of the company would usually travel a lot because they would need to see all the different offices, and they were still trying to find their feet and identify what roles they would fit in. And as we worked with them, and the project was led in my team back then by a young lady by the name of Serena, and she worked with them, did some surveys, questionnaires, and more we realized that actually the thing that will have the most impact is if we could make it available to them where they are and when they are, which essentially means their mobile phone. So we started breaking it down from there, and that resulted in the app called Discover. Discover was part of the Telefonica mantra, which was discover, deliver, disrupt. I'm not sure that's the right order. I apologize. It was a while ago. And Discover for us was the perfect title for the app. It was an app that would live on your phone. It was an app that you would register into using your initially your employee number, so the app would know that you are a Telefonica employee. It was a secure app, so we could either lock it or make sure that the phone is locked, and it would allow you to cache things on your device which would be useful. Now, this included resources around things like scheduling rooms in Outlook, but it also included things like, especially as it grew and became more popular, it included things like our maternity policy, which for some reason HR complained that nobody was reading and engaging with the 72-page document. It also included things as simple as the locations of the offices. So Telefonica back then had a big office in Leeds. But, you know, the simple act of getting to Leeds train station, how do I get from here to the office? You whip up Discover, say, I want to get to the office, and it tells you, this is where it is. Would you like me to map a route? And it will jump into Google Maps to do that. So it was pretty much like a Swiss Army knife of knowledge and information. And it was, I think, about 4 months into usage where we found out that people were still using it sometimes once every other day, sometimes every day. So it was very, very useful. And as a result, it continued to grow.
Perfect. I think, yeah, I guess, you know, just touching on some of the things which you said there, one of the things which jumped out to me was I thought it made the whole onboarding and induction experience a lot more streamlined, especially when you look at, say, you know, we'll use the term millennials, but let's just look at that. I mean, how many millennials actually use Outlook in general? The chances are they're using something like Gmail or Hotmail or whatever else. And it really is the little big things which on induction experiences and onboardings and stuff like that, it's the little things what get overlooked, what become the massive barriers, especially in the first, you know, 30, 60 days of joining a company. I think the Discover app really did a great job of kind of blocking that and stopping them, you know, stopping them barriers getting in the way, really. I think even at that time, it was pretty much way ahead of some of the stuff which I've seen recently with regard to kind of onboarding experiences and stuff like that.
I think there's always a battle in what we offer our colleagues, our employees, in terms of, some people still talk about how many people L&D has been in touch with. I think, I don't remember, I think maybe on the WhatsApp group that somebody mentioned that there was a manager that say, we've touched so many people. Of course, very wrong to say today, but, you know, when L&D prides itself on how many people have gone through a course, you know there's something wrong. If you want to put bums on seats, as it's known, go be in a university, go work for a school. But I constantly talk about the fact that I'm not, you know, I enjoy learning personally, but I'm not here to make the employees of Kingfisher or Telefonica more learned. I'm here to make them better at their job, to help them do fulfill their employment-related responsibilities better. So if I can do that by putting a map on their mobile and they haven't learned anything, then I would put a map on the mobile rather than send them on a course because it's the right thing to do and it's the fastest thing to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I use this analogy of kind of fish where the fishes live. And for me, I guess Discover was a great example of that. Kind of rather than recreating the wheel, let's just go where they already are, the mobile device, and let's kind of address
Absolutely.
That. And then it was a very, very good example of the kind of whole mantra of just the right amount of information at just the right time. So yeah, it was great. So then we go from Telefonica to, I think you go with it. Is it where's next? Is it AXA?
Yeah. So I left Telefonica after about 3 years, I think, and I then moved to AXA Insurance for about a year. There was an interesting opportunity there to rebuild the L&D, at the time being headed by Laura Pettit, who ex-Bupa was very, very innovative, very, very charismatic leader. Loved working with her. Unfortunately, the landscape of the company changed, and it was time to move on after a year, finish the deployment of Cornerstone On Demand, which is an LMS, and moved on. Did a few interesting projects, but nothing that had very big longevity. I think the only thing that I would talk about from that period was a project that we did for compliance this time, which is something I didn't do at Telefonica, and that was around an FCA change of regulation, Financial Conduct Authority, and we needed to reach 2,400 people within literally, I think we had 3 months. We had very little money, and we at that time said, okay, so we can do courses or we can use this PowerPoint that we use. And I don't like it. I think PowerPoint has its uses, although again, bullet points is not exactly my favorite, but it's not a tool for learning, and especially not when you need to understand, and for me with compliance, you need to understand what the learners have actually taken in and what they haven't. So we used a very innovative, very different system by the name of Jollydeck. And Jollydeck is very interesting because rather than give you a screen to read and then hit next, it gives you the content is device independent, so you can do it on your phone or on the laptop or on the tablet, which is, again, not new. But what it does is it's in the form of a conversation, and you have a coach who leads you through the conversation. In AXA, we chose a Japanese samurai. Please don't ask me why. I won't be able to explain. And the guy was a little bit cheeky. Master Hanzo, as he's called, led the 2,400 people through the learning, and we got it done within 6 weeks, which was very, very unusual. Compliance usually takes months to reach the whole base, and if you look at some of the writing from Towards Maturity, then you usually talk about 77% as the average for UK compliance levels. And in AXA, we did pretty much 100% within 6 weeks. So it was quite a success.
Wow. Okay. So then AXA, you come to Kingfisher, which is where you're at now, I see, yeah?
Yeah. So I was called up by somebody who worked not even directly with me, but who worked adjacent to me in Telefonica, and said, "I remember some of the stuff you did, and would be interested in maybe you can do something for us." Kingfisher is going through a phenomenal journey of becoming. So previously, Kingfisher was essentially just a financial holding company for a network of stores in different countries. So B&Q and Screwfix are the best known, are the ones that we have in the UK, and you probably are familiar with both. And we have similar brands in France, Castorama and Brico Dépôt, Russia, Poland, Spain, and so on, and quite a few other locations. And it's now moving from being this disparate collection of entities into a one Kingfisher, which is a single group which has a more unified culture and approach to things. And as part of that, there is a very interesting journey for the way we look at the colleague experience and the way employees are supported.
Okay, so I guess. Thanks for giving me a bit of a brief, a bio over kind of where you've come from and where you are right now, I say. So what I think we'll do now is we'll jump into something. I'm going to say a few words, and I want you to tell me what comes to mind once I say these words.
Okay.
Okay, so the first one is, and it's probably a sentence more than a word, to be honest, click next e-learning.
Oh, click next or cluck next. So for me, click next is next next. And I don't think that even in the days of four colors on the spectrum or whatever it was, there was an excuse to develop that. That said, and because I try to be truthful, I am guilty of sometimes being involved in projects which produced that kind of stuff. And I think the only mitigating circumstances which could be for next learning is if the narrative is really, really good. And what I mean by that is if what you go through the screen makes you say, "Oh, you know what? Yes, I want to know more," or "Yes, I want to learn more about this," or "read more about this," then that is a mitigating circumstance. Still not impressive. But I think, I don't know if you, Danny, remember the NSPCC learning in that we had in Telefonica. That was almost a next, but there was a narrative. There was there was a story being told. There was a reason behind it, and I think that is okay. Other than that, if you do a next learning, just print it on a book and ask them to phone you up when they finished.
Okay, the next one is gamification.
I think we learning people love our models and love our buzzwords. I think gamification today is what mobile learning was a few years back. We always look for the magic single magic solution. We will never find it because there isn't a magic single solution, in the same way that a chef doesn't cook one dish and a carpenter doesn't use one tool. Gamification elements or gamifying or whatever it is called, whatever the correct grammar expression is. The idea of including humor, the idea of including things like points and challenges. This is not new. And I can tell you about, or maybe I'm not allowed to tell you about, but I can re clearly remember stuff that was done in the early 90s, which, if you went through the description of what gamification is, definitely would fall under that title. It's a tool. It's a tool, no matter what you call it. In some cases, it is useful. In other cases, it is not. I would be very careful of sweeping statements of, "Oh yeah, it's the savior," or "It's the devil," about anything in our field.
Okay. Next one is micro learning.
Are we allowed to talk about that? Hasn't it been trademarked by a certain company? for me, just to jump back, 45 minutes learning, which, yes, it was 45 minute lessons in school, but come on, digital learning really doesn't need to adhere to that. For me, shorter bursts of learning make a lot more sense. Just as an example, the GDPR, which is simply the current latest thing that we're rolling out in Kingfisher, on average takes our learners about 22 minutes. There's a lot of so I'm a big fan of making it shorter. Absolutely. I'm also a big fan of making it breakable. So if I mentioned before the tool we used in AXA for the compliance learning, and we're using the same tool, Jollydeck, here at Kingfisher for GDPR, because it's a conversation, you can put it down at any moment, just like you don't continue to text your mom when the movie starts, I hope. And you can then pick it up and continue from exactly the same space, again, as you would do in a conversation. And that, to me, is exactly what micro learning is about. In the same way that we've made books by reading them 2 minutes here and 3 minutes there, into something that is micro reading. There you go. I want to trademark that. So those I'm very happy with. What I'm not happy with and what I'm very worried about is the attention span. So apparently now we have worse attention span than goldfish. I'm not going to be mean. I think the only people that probably applies to is politicians. But apart from them, people watch movies of 2 hours. People sit through operas of more than 2 hours. If the narrative is good, if it's interesting, then it can take days. I don't buy the fact that attention span has gone down, and I don't buy the fact that microlearning is the only thing out there. I think we have sinned with 45-minute pieces of boring next learning, and now we're trying to repent for it. But microlearning, just like gamification, is a tool, and a good one at that.
Okay. We'll do two more before we move on. So, next one
Okay.
is XAPI.
Never heard of that.
Oh, I was like, what?
Sorry, I was keeping that. XAPI. So XAPI is one of the standards for tracking learning and digital learning specifically. So up until today, SCORM would have been the way in which a piece of content interacts with a learning management system. So if you think about it, think about I'll expose my age here. Think about a VCR or a CD-ROM. CD-ROM needs to be written in a certain way so that a CD reader can read it and play us the music. In the same way, for pieces of learning, they need to be written in a certain way for a learning management system to be able to deliver it and to be able to then get the results back. As a result, most of the content that we have today will be able to say, Danny has started learning lesson X. Danny has passed lesson X if you answered enough questions correctly. Danny has completed lesson X if you've watched the last slide and you've gone through it. Now, that is okay. It means that I can take a piece of learning from, I don't know what I mentioned, Cornerstone On Demand before, and put it on another LMS like Docebo without needing any reprogramming. And both of them will understand how to start the lesson and how to complete it. XAPI acknowledges the fact that that is not how we work on a day-to-day basis. So XAPI was a new standard for tracking learning, or actually, what's more accurate, it's a new standard for tracking digital asset usage. So XAPI could record something like Danny watched 2 minutes of YouTube video X. What that means is that SCORM and XAPI can live together. It also means that we finally can start looking at data in a very different way. If we compare digital learning to classroom-based learning, you know, 45 minutes we inherited and so on, there is something that in digital learning we've never been able to do. And I can say that as somebody who's, you know, been standing in front of a classroom of people. When you go through stuff, an experienced teacher will tell you that you can see the moment somebody gets something or if they don't get something. And then it's very easy to say, ah, you know, Mikey, I see that you don't understand. Or Mikey, do you understand this? And Mikey will say, no, I don't. So you go over it again. And you can see when Mikey finally gets it. XAPI will allow us, when used correctly, to start looking into the brain of our learners. As an example, and not necessarily XAPI, but as an example of how to use tracking data, we have deployed the GDPR about a month ago in Kingfisher. We have 82,000 employees. And one of the things we did was, like most companies out there, compliance, we have a learning module and a test afterwards. This is not very innovative, not very interesting. What we did was in some of the questions, which are the important ones, we matched the questions. So, for example, one of the things in GDPR, which is important, is when a customer asks you for the information that you hold about them, they have to make a formal request in writing. And a lot of people skip that and think that a verbal request is good enough. So what we did, if we take that as an important component, is we explained this during the learning and we gave an example. You know, you're at the till in B&Q, somebody asks you for the information you hold about them. Is this a formal request? And the answer obviously is no. What we're seeing through the data is that during the learning, a lot of people miss that. And they say, yes, it is a formal request. But then in the testing, we come back and we present the question in a different way, and we can identify a very simple uptake there. So during the learning, they're failing it, and then during the test, they're getting it right. So we know that there is learning here. And we know that the people who go through it, in the vast majority of cases, understand after going through this that learning understand that a verbal request is not an official request when it comes to personal related data. So we, again, inherited from the old classroom, from the old school. We give them a test, they pass the test, they've learned, yay. But we can do a lot more with data. We can do a lot more with the understanding of where our learners are, where our colleagues, our employees are, and how we can help them better. So, for example, if we would have, with the GDPR, if we would have continued to see that people do not understand this verbal issue, then we would have easily said, right, here is an update for the learning. We've now included more information about this verbal request, or do something in that context. But I think the learning is not a one-way street. We don't, you know, it's not a vomitarium. We don't just puke the information on them and they just gobble it up like young penguins. We need to do something, and then they do something, and then we do something. So it's a two-way street.
Okay, makes sense. And the last one is Asi Degane. What springs to mind when I say your name?
Never heard of that either. What springs to mind when you say my name? I'm not sure I have an answer for that. Okay. I think, I'm comfortable. If you ask me professionally who I am, I'm very comfortable with what I do. I think the field that I'm in is a field that is still growing, is still becoming. I'm a very shy individual. And everybody always tells me, oh, you know, when I give talks and when I talk about something, say, oh, that was really interesting. Thank you for sharing. You're a very good speaker. So I'm a horrible speaker. As long as I speak about something interesting and I enjoy it, something that I'm passionate about, do it any day. If you ask me about myself, yeah.
Okay.
Next.
Yeah, cool. So let's jump into some different type of questions then. So if I was to ask you, I see, what book would you give to three people as a gift? What book would you recommend?
Oh wow, this is going to sound horrible, but I am not reading as much as I should be, sadly. There's a few books that I'm a big fan of. One of them, and I think that the one book that I'm just Googling to remember the full title. So it's What Video Games Can Teach Us About Literacy and Learning, a very, very interesting book, which had, for me personally, had profound effects on how I do some things and how I look at things. And it's by James Paul G. Very, very interesting book, well worth reading.
Okay, superb.
Other than that, probably the Checklist Manifesto, which I think is important. And I would love to say that I've read everything that Julian Stodd has written, but that would be a blatant lie. So I'm not going to say it, but I'd recommend looking up the stuff that Julian Stodd writes.
Okay, superb. Checklist Manifesto is a great book. I think I've read it twice over now. And every time I read it, I seem to pull different things from it every time I've read it.
Yeah.
So it's a great book. So I guess, you know, I said,
and in fact, we're doing now is we're working checklists into the onboarding process and into the support process. So we're looking at how to create checklists from two angles. One is the angle of this is how you do X, you know, this is how you use a piece of software, or this, and also as a memory reinforcer device for learners where they create and share checklists for themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, if anyone who's read the book, maybe it's for people who haven't, you know, checklists have been used for aviation for years. And I think if it works for aviation, who are we to kind of say, no, it can't work for learning development, I guess. You know, when we designed the onboarding experience for kind of the likes of TalkTalk and stuff, checklists, we've kind of used checklists for a bit now. We kind of brought them in. It was a case of, it's just easy as a reference point to just go back to rather than reading through 10 pages of fluff just to get the key call outs. But obviously this podcast is all about the person behind the learning. So you asked it. So I guess what's one of your biggest 80-20s? And it can be personal, it can be professional. So example being, you know, 20% of the contacts in my phone, I dial 80% of the time. The other 80% of them, I probably dial 20% of the time. So what's your biggest hack? Maybe it's in life or in your professional life that you tend to use on a day-to-day basis.
My biggest hack that I use on a day-to-day basis. If my children are not going to hear this podcast, then I can say that I'm addicted to my phone. I will try any crap. Sorry, I'll try anything. Which would mean new apps or whatever. I think there was a brief period in Telefonica where I was trying to convince my team to do every project using different tools. Not always very successful, but you know, it did mean that we got to meet tools like Trello when it was very, very, very young and other things. I think the problem, what scares me is when people stop trying new things, you know, and you become, oh yeah, I'm doing that because that's what I've done for 15 years. So, you know, I keep on doing it. So I try a lot. One of the things that I do very, hack, to stay with the term hack, is my Instapaper, which is available on every tool that I have. So Instapaper is a very nice tool for caching web pages. So if I browse through something, maybe it's LinkedIn or maybe it's something else, somebody mentions an article or something that I think is worth reading, I'll load it, cache it into my Instapaper, and then every few weeks, every few months, when I'm on vacation or when I have more time, the Instapaper downloads everything to my phone and I can sit down quietly and read, which is why I have moved quite significantly away from books and into articles. So it's always in my Insta paper, and it really, really works for me.
Okay, that's cool. And yes, you put me onto Insta paper. I think when we last met, I think it was at an event. And you can, you pointed out Insta paper to me, and ever since I've literally used it every day. So yeah, thank you.
I think the problem is and that's exactly it. So if you look at my browser, usually I will have a bazillion tabs open because I have I'm not willing to let go of an article that I need to read. Insta paper has made it easier for me to say, right, I can close it because it's an Insta paper, and I'll get back to it at some point.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I think for tabs, the one thing I've been using quite a lot recently is a plugin for Chrome called OneTab.
Yeah.
So basically what it does is it it's just a nice simple tool. So anyway, we went off tangent. So if I was to say to you, what is the future of digital learning? I say, how would you define that? And obviously I use digital learning in a very open-ended kind of way because everyone has a different take on what digital learning is. So what's your take on it?
So for me, digital learning is when we use digital tools, and that could be anything from your TV to your personal phone, to your laptop, to your desktop, to your car, to enhance what you know, how you do, or to improve how you do things, and so on. I think for me, learning in its most basic form is something that affects what or how we do things. And I always go down to, you know, the most primitive and basic example of learning, which is mother tigress bringing a wounded gazelle to the cubs, and you know that's your learning content, and they then have an exercise where they pretend to hunt. That's how they learn. We are moving, I think, right now, so the near future of learning is moving from technology supported to technology led. Today, in most places, or in many places, I don't know if it's most anymore, we still look at digital learning as a support to the classroom stuff. And I think we need to grow up. And it'll happen whether we like it or not. But us old people still think for some reason that, you know, classroom is best, face-to-face is best, and then we need some digital to top that. But the fact of the matter is that if you structure the learning and the content, the support mechanism that you're building, the scaffolding properly, then you have a very brief micro learning to introduce a subject, but then it's all about support mechanism in real time. I think the there are two futures, or there are two halves to the future. So one half is the dark side, where we have over personalization. We're seeing it now happening with news, and we will see it happen with learning. This is the over personalization, the learning style future, where, you know, we're relying on things that are not true to deliver things that are less effective, and so on. And the other half is the positive half for me, where we are accessing stuff at the moment of need. We are accessing relevant stuff. We are, you know, it's okay for us to ask questions. We get the answers, and you know, even today, and this is an example I often give, is when I was growing up, if I would have told my my mates, you know, oh, let me jump to the library to find the answer to a question, I probably wouldn't made it home. Today, if somebody asks you a question, say, oh, I don't know, let me whip up my phone and find the answer, people say, oh, yeah, that's fine, that'll be interesting. And we, as learning professionals, need to thank our stars every morning and every evening for this, because the reason we needed the vomitarium many years ago was because learning was horrible. Not knowing was the worst thing you could do. You know, a leader knows, and if you don't know, you're not good enough. Today, knowing the fact, knowing that specific piece of information is a lot less important than knowing how to find it or knowing how to use it. And I think the where and how have become a lot more critical than the what, especially when the what changes, you know, because the things that we know about many things is changing. So it's a lot more important in my mind to be able to use the tools that give us the information. The one thing that I think we desperately need to thread into this future, the faster, the better, is critical skills. Because we, and I'm one of those who's very happy to complain about fake news, but then when you ask the people who read the fake news, you know, why didn't you use your head and compare and check? And so, oh, I didn't know. How can I check the sources? How can I look into it? Well, we're guilty of it sometimes as well. And we need to make sure that the way that we deal with learning, the way that we offer it, is reliable, coherent, sustainable. Sometimes things will change and we need to adapt, and that's fine. But at the moment of writing, things need to be right, and they need to be presented in the right way.
Okay, perfect. I think I watched the video probably about a week ago now, and I think they're using the term deep fake. Basically what we're doing is they're attaching faces. Did you see the video of Barack Obama? Have you seen that one? So I was just amazed by that. I was just like, wow, it's really interesting, but also really, really scary. And I just think how soon will, you know, the next step is going to be, this is kind of, you know, you look at kind of the hacks with Russia and stuff and the voting and whatever else. But I just think this is the next
step. We need to fight back. We need to fight back. I mean, in some cases, I remember some of the sci-fi movies, and I'm not going to geek out, but there's a famous TV series, and in one of the episodes, what they do is they say, oh no, we don't need to, we're not going to force you to say something, we're just going to use a simulation on the computer, and yet, you know, 2018, and we're already doing that, and it's enough that you get it over not very clear video and somebody says, oh yeah, you know, this is what politician X said when they closed the microphones off. You go, what? Really? There you go. That's a new war starting.
It's scary, but fascinating at the same time. So let's make things a little bit tougher for you. So other than Instapaper, and you can't use Google or social media, what's the top three resources or tools what you are using right now, or you've constantly come back to?
So I have a few websites that I read, which do not constitute social media stuff. I mean, LinkedIn for me, rather than Facebook, has a high value because you know I can hear what other, or I can read. Sorry, I can read what other people are discussing and talking about, and I think that's very, very useful. I'm a big fan of events, so conferences and the likes. Does that count?
We'll allow it. I said we'll allow it. Let's.
Okay. So for me, there are a few websites. I like CNET. I do a few, you know, some of those. There are a few news aggregators. Although I have to say that it seems as if they're less than they used to be. So if you think about Flipboard or News 360, so these are news aggregators, which I use because it gives me the opportunity to look at the same story from different angles, especially if it's not something I'm familiar with. I think there's quite a few tools on the phone itself that I use regularly. You know, Outlook for me on the phone is open more than it is on the computer. Wunderlist, which is a to-do list, checklist that we spoke about, is one of my favorite apps. TripIt, TripIt is an app that I cannot live without, having gotten used to it, whether it's work or vacation. So Google Keep, TripIt, that's the kind of stuff, and the website.
Okay, nice. That's cool. I think Google Keep is a brilliant tool. I mean, I tend to use that for pretty much everything now, especially now you've got your voice recorder on it as well. So rather than actually even typing, you can just log your voice note in there. So what's the best bit? This is going to sound really strange, but I'll go with it. What's the best bit of bad advice you hear given or you see? Let's do it that way. So what's the bad advice you see in our industry where you're like, no, that's wrong?
Did I mention learning styles before? I don't want to mention it too many times just in case somebody says, oh, he says learning styles a lot. That must be good. I think I think one form of bad advice is a single solution to everything. That worries me. And it worries me because the first time that I heard, so what's the answer? Is when I was doing my first instructional design course, which was in 1991, I think, or even earlier, and somebody, one of the students, one of the students asked, okay, so what's the answer? And it took us a while. What he was asking was, okay, so what's the answer to, what is the single equation to good instructional design? What is the single answer that will make our learners learn? And we all turned to the teacher, to the presenter, to see how he would tackle it. And I think it took him as well a few minutes to understand what the question actually was. I am very worried when people say, oh, you know, this, we only use tool X, or we only use approach Y. Keep on learning about learning. Keep on looking around and try things. It could be possible that something that other people say is wrong will actually work with for you, but make sure you have the evidence. Because if you say, oh, you know, I'll give a horrible example, but if, you know, I love learning styles, okay, so I've used them, okay, do you have evidence that they work? If you have evidence that they work, well done you, but if you have evidence that they work, then use them. But one of my problems, specifically with learning styles and with other things, is that people pick them up when there's no evidence and, you know, invest millions in it or time or whatever it is, and then end up with something that actually isn't any better than what it could be if they hadn't invested those millions. So for me, any advice that is advised without backing is bad advice, which is one of the reasons why I am a big fan of Patty Shank. You know, looking at her stream on LinkedIn, the last presentation she gave at the Learning Technologies Conference is very, very important. And be careful of making assumption. Again, oh, you know, if we do this, it'll be great for everybody. Check. Always check.
Okay. So I put a post out on the WhatsApp group and via LinkedIn, and just for any questions, what could be kind of pinged towards you. And I've got one which kind of jumped out to me. So Spencer asked, kind of, how do you overcome rollout to a desperate group without consistent company details, i.e. systems, devices? How would you approach that?
So I go around it. I don't even approach it. So obviously, I share the fact that we recently deployed GDPR in Kingfisher without having, a singular LMS, or for that matter, a singular database of people. And just to make it more fun, a large number of our people, about 50%, don't have email addresses. So you cannot even send them an email, say, dear so-and-so, you need to do your GDPR training. So what we did was a mixture of, so we went with a provider, which I think I mentioned is Jollydeck, and they provided us with their platform, which is a platform independent solution. So you can use it on tablets, browsers, there's a mobile app, whatever you prefer. And if you move from one to the other, so you can stop after 5 minutes on your phone and pick it up on your PC and it'll be in the same place. So that was the platform. What we did on the other hand is, or in addition to that, we made it easy to access. So there is a QR code and we went out with comms that anybody could scan the QR code and it will take them to a login page where all they'll need to do is put their last name and employee number and the system will let them go in. And the data itself came from each of the companies that is part of the Kingfisher Group. And that was just asking, begging, whatever you want to call it, for their list of employees. And what we did was list of employees with employee number or email address, put all of that into the system, and the system will either take you through your personalized link, which was sent to your email address, or if you use your employee number and last name, you can go through a generic portal. It wasn't without problems. There are people who left and we didn't get the update in time. There are people who joined and again, same thing. But for what is now close to 84% of that population, we have been able to deliver the learning. It's in 8 languages. So I think, it's been quite a learning. It's been quite a learning, but there have been fun points as well. I think, when you get across to that population and they react positively, they finish and they know what this is about and they understand, if I come to a B&Q employee now, for example, and say, oh, GDPR, say, oh, yes, what do you need to know about it? That is, for me, that is a reward in its own right. And
okay.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on some of the challenges. It's not easy by any means. It sounds very easy when you say it, but it's a lot of work, a lot of work.
Yeah. No, it sounds like it, but it sounds like a great success story as well. That's it. I guess what's, we've gone just past the hour mark now, so I'll quickly wrap this up with you. But what's the one thing you see, maybe in the industry, maybe it's an idea that you wish you came up with? And let's not go with the usual stuff, so it can't be like the internet or Google. What's maybe it's a tool in what you use in day-to-day life, I don't know.
Anything that made a lot of money for the people who created it. what is the thing that, oh, wow. I don't know if there is, I'm not an inventor. I cannot tell you that I thought about a new way to do X. I didn't think about a new tool or whatever it is. I think what personally I am attracted to and am interested in is the ways in which we use what we have. And I think there are some very interesting projects out there which I'm very envious at and they're more about an innovative way of using something that's already out there, and in that respect I think that's part of what I'm trying to do when I'm trying to put the mobile to good use.
Okay, no, and that's a great answer, I guess. What's maybe, yeah, I think we've kind of hit the point there. I say, I guess, at the start of the session, we asked you to pick 4 numbers. So let's come back round to that. So basically, these 4 numbers, I tie it to a list of which I've created of random objects. And the idea is really simple. You're on a desert island, and these are the 4 objects which your numbers are tallied to. So you have a stop sign.
Okay.
A stop sign.
Say that again?
A stop sign. Yep.
Okay.
A paintbrush.
Yeah.
A pool stick. And some toothpaste. What do you do with these items on a desert island?
Whoa. Okay. Without preparation. I guess I can use the stop sign to defend myself from dangerous animals and to hunt. I can keep my teeth clean, obviously. Oh, wow. So we had the stop sign, the toothpaste. What were the other two?
A paintbrush and a pool
Yeah.
stick, a snooker stick.
The paintbrush is the one that's getting to me. What would I do with a paintbrush on a desert island? Wow. I'm not sure. Once I build my retreat, I will use it to paint. Obviously, it's a B&Q paintbrush, and that's very important. But I don't know. I'm sure there are more creative people than me.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. And when I looked at these the list which I created, I was like, wow, these are some really hard items here. I don't know what I would do with some of them. Okay, cool. So at the start, I asked you what it is, when you was in school, what it is you wanted to be when you grow up. And realistically, we never stop learning, we never stop developing. So if I was to ask you the question now, Asa, in the moment what you're in now, what is it you want to be when you grow up? What would you say?
I enjoy what I do immensely, and I would like to grow in what I do. So, I don't know if you're expecting a title as a response, but I think for me, just as a personal anecdote, when I was in certain organizations where I was responsible for the local learning technology, I had my I still do had my opinions about how things should be run, and I tend to complain or tend to express my opinions about the fact that these guys at headquarters, the international headquarters, don't understand what's going on locally. If only they did. And so, so back then my aspiration was to be in the international headquarters so I could help my local colleagues and make things better, because obviously I would understand when I was at HQ. I have to say that I have now gotten what I wished for, and I would like to recommend to everybody, be very careful what you wish for. It's not always as shiny as it looks from where you are, but it has been it's been very interesting. I've been working very closely with the steering group of local L&D professionals, but yeah, the higher up you are in the structure, it simply means the problems are bigger. It doesn't mean that they go away.
Okay, great advice. Great advice. So, actually, where can people find out a little bit more about you and your message, so to speak?
My message: I am doing a horrible job. So I used to be better at sharing and I don't know if publishing, but I do as much as I can where I can. Because of the amount of work that we had have at Kingfisher and the fact that we're just now building the infrastructure, I have very little time. But I am part of the ELN, the e-learning network's mentoring program. So if you're looking for a mentor and you end up with me, God help you. I'm more than happy to chat with anybody. Whether it's LinkedIn or the WhatsApp group, always happy to share what I've learned. And as you know, whenever I run into people who I think can benefit from industry wisdom, they're invited into the group. And yeah, feel free to contact me directly. Just if you are sending a request on LinkedIn, just please write a line or two, a generic request. I tend to ignore those.
Okay, perfect. I say, well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cheers, I say.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Bye bye.